Merci beaucoup, Dominique. Well, I'm saying thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank the organizers for inviting me, and it has been a tremendous conference so far. Well, Mesopotamian demons, alien and yet native powers. The history of Mesopotamia is characterized by one dynamic factor. The open borders of the alluvial plains of the two rivers Euphrates and Tigris, both towards the mountain valleys of the Zagros Mountains to the east and the elevated plains of the Syrian desert to the west. This open landscape, which stands in marked contrast to the relative seclusiveness of the Egyptian Nile Valley, fundamentally shaped Mesopotamian history and culture. Tribes from the hilly flanks of the Zagros Mountains, or even from the Iranian high plateau, often invaded and plundered the rich lowlands of Sumer and Akkad. The Elamites in southwestern Iran formed a kind of long-standing enemy to Mesopotamia. The Gutians and Lulubians constantly threatened the first empires in the 3rd millennium BC. The Kassites, a tribe from the northeastern Zagros, migrated into the north of Mesopotamia at the end of the 3rd millennium and became a major power in the course of the 2nd millennium BC. From the west, several waves of Semitic-speaking nomadic tribes invaded the rich country between the two rivers over a period of 2 millennia, settled there and adapted to the culture of the local inhabitants. Akkadians, Amorites, and Arameans thus developed from loosely organized nomadic conglomerates to city-dwelling people, which in course of time formed mighty nations. These unstable political, social, and military conditions had an enormous impact on the attitude of life of the Mesopotamians. Apart from a deep feel for the temporality of peace, abundance, and human happiness, for the changing temper of the gods, and for the vanity of all human ambition, it also provided them with clear views about foreigners. They were considered to be uncultured barbarians, stupid nomads, and unlettered hillbillies, who spoke in a funny way and were even too dumpish to venerate the gods appropriately. Just to give two examples for this. The language of the people of Zipemena in the land of Zamua in the mountains to the northeast of Assyria sounded to the Assyrians in the 9th century BC extremely peculiar. It prompted the remark in the annals of King Ashurnasirpal that language sounded like, quote, the tweet of women, unquote, or even, quote, the tweet of birds, unquote. And a text called today Curse of Akkadi tells how King Naram-Sin of Akkadi had angered the goddess Ishtar, and the gods brought the tribes of the Lulubin down on Akkadi. The victorious Lulubins then in turn fell out with the gods. Out of ignorance, they stole the gods' meals in their temples, offended them, and their rule was ended soon afterwards. Foreigners were considered to be so peculiar and indeed dangerous in Mesopotamian thought that sometimes they appeared not to be human at all. Another legend of the old Akkadian kings, the so-called Kusin legend of Naram-Sin, is quite revealing in this respect. This legend recounts how the troops of King Naram-Sin were dismayed on their campaign against the Lulubins, and they doubted their enemies were human. They surmised the Lulubins could be demons. As it was told, they were, quote, a people with partridge bodies, a race with raven faces, unquote. So Naram-Sin decided to put it to the test. And he wrote, I summoned an army scout and instructed him. I handed over to him a stiletto and a pin. Strike them with a stiletto, prick them with a pin. If blood comes out, they are men like us. If blood does not come out, they are evil spirits, messengers of death, fiends, malevolent demons, creatures of Enlil. The scout brought back this report. I struck them with a stiletto, I pricked them with a pin, and blood did come out. So we heard about this already from Lionel Matisse's talk on yesterday. The possibility to consider enemies as potential or real demons is interesting as it illustrates an aspect that foreign enemies and demons have in common. They share the same habitat. Just like foreigners, Demons live in the mountains to the east and steppes to the west. The mountains were the home of the wind and storm demons like the evil seven, who bear down from the mountains on the pastures, fields, villages, and towns of the civilized lands between the river. The steppes are the home of those spirits of the unburied dead who particularly hound their own family, but also travelers taken at unawares. The devastating actions of the wind demons and their home in the mountains is perhaps best explained by means of the king of the wind demons himself, Pazuzu. A widespread incantation concerning Pazuzu reads, "Incantation, you, mighty one, who ascends the mountains, who faces all the winds, angry wind, whose rising is terrible, fierce one, raging one, who comes on furiously, who roars at the walled regions, who wrecks the high mountains, who parches the marshland, who withers its reeds. He confronted the wood, dropped its trees. He passed to the gardens, dropped down its fruit. He descended to the river, poured out ice. He went up the dry land, covered it with hoarfrost. He struck the young man, hunched him over. He knocked the young woman, hit her womb. He descended to the river, poured out ice. He went up the dry land, covered it with hoarfrost. Agony of mankind, disease of mankind, suffering of mankind. Do not enter the house I enter. Do not come near the house I come near. Do not approach the house I approach. Be conjured and stay conjured by Anu and Antu, Enlil and Ninlil, Ea and Damkina, heaven and earth, incantation formula." This incantation vividly details the destructive power of Pazuzu when he rages down from the mountains to devastate the lands of the people. This demon was a relative latecomer to Mesopotamia. Pazuzu texts and representations are not attested before the end of the 8th century BC, but he became a favorite apotopeion from that time onwards. Representations of Pazuzu can be found all over the ancient Near East, from Egypt to Assyria, from Samos, from the island of Samos, to Iran. Pazuzu's aggressive character is splendidly illustrated by his iconography. A mixture of teriomorphic and anthropomorphic elements comprises his facial features. Most notable are a rectangular form of the head, capritic horns, canine jaws with teeth and tongue shown, and large round eyes set deep under thick eyebrows. A horizontally cut human beard, human ears, round bulges on his head, and a throat marked by horizontal lines are further features characteristic of this demon. A prolonged, small, almost famished canine body with protruding ribs, human or animal thighs and bird's talons, human shoulders and arms ending in the claws of a predator are also representative. Two pairs of bird's wings on his back, a penis erectus ending in a snake's head, and the tail of a scorpion, complete Pazuzu's iconography. While the iconography of the head is distinct and typical for Pazuzu, the image of his body is shared by a number of other demons. This importance of the head for the identification of Pazuzu is illustrated by the fact that the majority of representations of this demon only consist of the head, which is used pars pro toto for this demon. The usual introduction of this demon in the text or on the amulet reads, "I am Pazuzu, son of Rammi, king of evil Lilu demons." The names Pazuzu and Khanbu illustrate the foreign origin of these demons. While Pazuzu adheres to the form of the so-called banana names found in many languages, so Pazuzu, Pazaza, Bazaza, Banana, all these names who sound like this, the name of Pazuzu's father, Khanbu, might well be Elamite, Sutin, or Lulubin. Generally, demons are addressed as groups like the Lilu or the Utuku, Udohul demons, or take their designations from the most prominent characteristic, like, for example, the Rabitsu, lurker, or the Ahazu, the snatcher. But when demons do have their own distinctive name, it is foreign, very often from an Eastern language. The lord of demons, Almu Alamu, and Narundu, the sister of the seven demons, are prime examples of this. The foreignness of another famous Mesopotamian demon, Lamashtu, is directly underlined in the rituals and incantations directed against her. In one incantation, she is pictured as describing herself as a Sutin. I am the daughter of Anu from heaven. I am a Sutin. In another incantation, she is described as an Elamite. She is an Elamite woman. Big is her upru, her headgear. And the beginning of an old Babylonian incantation notes instead, she is fierce, to be feared, a goddess, an Amorite woman. Indeed, she is a she-wolf, the daughter of Anu. So in the old Babylonian text, Lamashtu is described as an Amorite woman, while in the standard text series of the first millennium BC, she's either Sutin or Elamite, in any case, Iranian. One cannot fail to notice the correspondence of this change with the political situation. At the end of the third and beginning of the second millennium BC, the Amorites posed a major threat to the kingdoms of Babylonia. While at the end of the second and beginning of the first millennium, the Iranian people were a constant danger to Assyria and Babylonia. The Mesopotamians depicted Lamashtu, a demon already known in the third millennium BC as Dimi, one of the infamous seven, with a lion head, a furry animal's body with a big human, with big human-like breasts, human hands, and a big bird of prey feet. Often she is shown in a boat and on a donkey at the same time, holding snakes in her hand and having a dog and a pig suckling her breasts. Again, at the same time, she is bound to a tamarisk tree and yet running. Many provisions and objects of female attire or personal care like comb, fibula, or mirror are depicted beside her, either to tempt her or to drive her away. So you can see these things right to the right of her. Pazuzu is shown in an attacking mode, driving her away. Other registers of the scene illustrate a bed scene with Helios, dressed in fish garb like the ancient Apkallu sages, the demons Ugalu and Lula, the seven demons, and the symbols of the great gods. Another Pazuzu figure is looking over the rim of the amulet. For us, it might look strange to see Lamashtu standing in a boat and on a donkey at the same time. But this is a strong visual picture for the phrase, Libia Nara Libal Kitshada, cross the river, traverse the mountains, which we find often used in incantations to drive demons over the rim into the steppe and into the mountains. For crossing the river, a boat is needed. For traversing the mountains, a donkey. And of course, it translates, she shall cross the river, she shall traverse the mountains, but I rather like to translate it as an imperative here. The case of Lamashtu also provides us with quite a few examples for demons being foreigners and native powers of Mesopotamia at the same time. Lamashtu is called daughter of Anu, time and again. And indeed, the Lamashtu texts tell us that as a misbegotten daughter of the chief god of the Babylonian pantheon, Anum, and thus a folly divine ancestry, she was thrown out of heaven and down to earth, where she lived on snatching and eating newly born babies. This is described in the Lamashtu series, Tablet 1, 110. She is not straightforward. So this means she's not really in the normal way, but rather a she-devil, the daughter of Anu. It was Anu, her father, and Anu, her mother, who, in view of her unseemly deeds, forced her to step down from heaven and also denied her a place of worship on earth. So this means she doesn't get anything to eat from the humans, and she has to live on snatching and eating babies. This passage not only indicates Lamashtu's divine ancestry, but also her fully Mesopotamian background. She's an integral, albeit dark part, of the Mesopotamian pantheon, even if she is called a foreigner, an Amorite, Sutin, or Elamite woman at the same time. This dual nature of her background is not mutually excluding, but takes her origin into view from different backgrounds. And she can be depicted in a boat and on a donkey, running and yet bound to a tamarisk tree at the same time. She is Mesopotamian and yet of foreign background. Can you see that she's bound to a tamarisk tree? Is that clear? Do we have some pointer? So here you can see she's here. She's tied to a tree here. And at the same time, she is running. And this is this way the knees are bent. This clearly shows clearly that she is running. This is the usual way the Mesopotamians depicted someone running quickly. This also serves to clarify the question of a Mesopotamian of foreign origin of the idea of the Lamashtu figure. While she is called a foreigner in the text, her place in the Mesopotamian pantheon clarifies that in all probability the idea of the Lamashtu demon is of Mesopotamian origin. Walter Faber remarks in his brand new edition of the Lamashtu text series along the same lines. Although not strictly provable, it thus seems reasonable to assume that in Old Babylonian and Old Assyrian times, Lamashtu spells were widely utilized wherever Akkadian and Sumerian texts were used for magic, and there is no indication in the textual record that the belief in Lamashtu was not rooted in Mesopotamian culture itself. Occasional references in the text to Lamashtu as a dangerous foreigner, i.e. as an Elamite, Sutin, or Amorite woman, in my opinion, reinforce this impression and are easier to explain from within Mesopotamian social and magical religious beliefs than if a figure and character had actually been borrowed or imported from some neighboring cultures. In this, the aforementioned Pazuzu may show a difference to Lamashtu, as his background is decidedly foreign, and as a latecomer to Mesopotamia in the first millennium BC, he might well be going back to religious beliefs not originating in Mesopotamia. This would be in accordance with his description as a demonic power originating in the mountains and coming down enraged to the Mesopotamian heartlands. Lamashtu, as a foreign and yet Mesopotamian demon, on the contrary, illustrates that demons do dwell in Mesopotamia proper and not just in the steppes to the west and the mountains of the east. Lamashtu's abode in the is the marshes, as again the Lamashtu texts tell us. There it's written, her abode is in the marshes, her lair is in the grass. She came up from the marshes and is widely raging. Mesopotamian demons live at the margins of culture, in lands quite uninhabitable for civilized people, like the Mesopotamian city dwellers. Inaccessible mountains, the unfriendly steppes, and the impenetrable marshlands are their abode. Those abundant areas are places where the passage to the netherworld is located in Babylonian thought, and is said about the evil seven. In the caves of the earth they crawl, the desert places of the earth are their abode. Now let me end with a story from the royal inscriptions of King Ashurbanipal from the middle of the 7th century BC, which is well suited to illustrate how deeply the idea of demons originating outside of Mesopotamia had sunk into the Mesopotamian mind. In this text, King Ashurbanipal describes the Cimmerian king of the enemy hordes he's fighting as Tukdame, the king of the Uman Manda, the Manda hordes, a creature of Tiamat, the likeness of a gallo demon. The Uman Manda was the Akkadian word for masses of barbarian enemy hordes of unknown origin. Already 1,700 years before, the old Akkadian king Naram-Sin had fought against Uman Manda, and as we have seen, there was always the doubt whether or not these people were human. The Galu demons are genderless entities serving in the netherworld, who by night left their dwellings in the netherworld and terrified people by spreading disease and death. Enraged and furious people with distorted facial features are compared to the Galu demon. This Tukdame is demonized by Ashurbanipal. He is a demon that has no part in the world of living man. But Ashurbanipal goes even further than that. By describing Tukdame as a creature of Tiamat, he lifts the military conflict on a mythological level. Tiamat, the monstrous incarnation of the salty seas, leading an army of demons, was a big enemy of the gods in the myth Enuma Elish, describing the fighting for supremacy amongst the gods, the rise of Marduk, or in Assyria, Ashur, to first rank, and the creation of the world as the Mesopotamians knew it. Ashurbanipal himself calls, Ashurbanipal calls himself a creature of Ashur, and by this he's intersecting the mythological narrative and the political events of his time. Thus, Ashurbanipal, fighting Tukdame, appears to be in the same line as Ashur or Marduk fighting Tiamat in the depths of mythological time. As anyone was well aware who read at that time Ashurbanipal's inscriptions, the fight of the gods against Tiamat ended with her being slaughtered like a stockfish, and anyone must have known that Tukdame could only have suffered the same fate. Thank you for your attention.